Respected Imam, elders, children of Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I can't believe so much time has passed. We spoke here on Somalia, it was 2011, and we're already in 2013. As that time, it was a tragedy where people were dying, children were dying because of famine and natural causes. In this case, it's far worse. I've never done such a major tour in a long time. The last time I did a major tour in the country was during the crisis in Bosnia. At that time, the tragedy was that Muslims were being killed by others. This time, the tragedy is worse. Muslims are being killed by others in the guise of Islam, by other Muslims, in the place called Syria, in which the whole world is all confused about. If you look at analyze the Muslims throughout the country and throughout the world, there has been an absolute lethargy and apathy and a need to respond. When the crisis took place in Bosnia, the earthquake in Pakistan, the floods in Pakistan, the crisis in Afghanistan, the battle in Gaza, the whole world responded spontaneously, rapidly, and with efficiency. We are all guilty, 1 billion of us, for cutting off Syria and the women and children suffering in that country for the last 2 years already. The problem is, either we're apathetic, or we're caught up in materialism, which I don't believe, or is that we just have the wrong information, or we don't have any information at all. I was in that same position. When there's a disaster, we are one of the fastest in the world to respond. 18 months, and even I was sleeping. Until somebody came to me on the 1st of October last year to the Joburg office. And I said to myself, this is from Allah. Why would somebody come all the way from Turkey to Joburg, show me some pictures, explain me the situation, and say that he himself was across the border from Syria and he didn't know what was going on, living right there. And he was the Al Jazeera bureau chief in Turkey. A Palestinian, soft person, and he was just crying as he was speaking. They've been through the difficulty, so they know what hardship is all about. So the following week, I went to go see for myself, because the world created the impression that this was some sectarian strife, so we're not interested. It created the impression that Saudi Arabia and Qatar were taking care of it. So when you hear Saudi Arabia and Qatar, you think petrodollars, multiple money, no problem, everything is taken care of. Especially in the context of the last 21 years. Because in Bosnia, in Afghanistan, in the floods and in the earthquake, Saudi Arabia would send government planes, send money, and send a whole lot of agencies. And so would Jordan and UAE and Bahrain and Qatar would send. So all of us thought, it's fine. Then we were told Turkey is taking care of the people, 100,000 refugees on the border. And we said, yes, Islamist government, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, no problem, everything is taken care of. So we sat back. And then we were told, no, there's something else happening here. The Americans want to get involved. NATO wants to get involved. The British and the French want to get involved. And then all our brains started working. Yeah, this is something to unsettle Assad, because Assad is a good man. He's fighting Israel. Hezbollah is fighting Israel. Iran is fighting Israel. So if you fight Israel, does that make you a hero? By what standards are we measuring? Are we measuring according to international standards, political standards, or Quranic standards? The problem is that we as Muslims are very emotional, very irrational, and we forget to measure against Quranic standards. And because of that, we sit behind thinking who is going to benefit, extreme terrorists, Free Syrian Army, you know, all kinds of rebels, all kinds of names, but we never sat back once and analyze what are these rebels? Who is this Free Syrian Army? What's going on inside Syria? It's very simple. You see, before 1994, the people in this country stood up. They said, we don't want an oppressive government. We don't want apartheid. We want justice, and we want fairness, and we want liberation. They never wanted to bring burned houses and bring things down. They were forced to it at some point, but it was peaceful by far and large. And the transition took place, and things happened peacefully. The whole world didn't object. They supported the ANC and the liberation movements, because it was a fight for injustice, against injustice and against oppression. The Arab Spring was about the same thing. It was a fight about injustice in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya. It happened. Nobody batted an eyelid. But why in Syria did the whole world pull back? Why is there no humanitarian agencies in a big way? Why are there no safe havens? Why is there no protection to stop the war like they did in Bosnia, like they brought NATO into Libya? Why have they not allowed that and done that in Syria? Killing continues every single day. Of course, if the whole world doesn't do anything, I can accept that. But what I can't accept is the Muslim world sleeping about that. How is that allowed? And because we said terrorists and rebels, so we got confused. So I went in. I walked into Darkush on October 13th in the North Syrian city, one of the North Syrian cities. I walked into the plantation and I met the rebel fighters. Everything but fighters. Everything but an army. Youngsters, 15 years old, 20 years old, with jeans and shirt and jackets. Wearing guns, I don't even know how to even control those weapons. But they welcomed me and Ahmed Bam with a pleasant face. Who are you? Where are you from? South Africa. South Africa? You coming from that side all the way to here? We don't see anybody from outside here. Walk in. The first thing but pride they tell me. They say, do you know about Syria? The Prophet called it Asham. The place that is blessed. He blessed. He said, they said, if you want to see a part of Jannah, it is here in Syria. We don't know where in Syria, but it is somewhere here. And as I walked to the plantation, what plantation was it? Pomegranates. What is the fruit of Jannah? Pomegranate. And as we walked further in, with smiling faces, they said, do you know who liberated Darkush? They said, Umar bin Khattab, radiallahu anhu, send Abu Ubaidah bin Jarrah. They said, do you know Abu Ubaidah bin Jarrah? He is the Ashram Mubashara, one of the 10 promised paradise in this world. And he came to liberate us. We are proud of our history. And as I walked further, I met a tall man. He said, brother, I don't know you. I don't know where you come from, but look at me. Do I look like a terrorist? And I looked at him, up and down. I said, yes. He said, what do you mean? I said, look at the size of your beard. According to international standards, the longer the beard, the bigger the terrorist. That's how the world has been warped. His eyes went sad. His eyes went sad. He said, I look after plants. I look after cattle. I'm a farmer. I carry this gun which I don't even know how to use. I'm only using this to protect my family, to prevent them from the fate that other people like me, other women, other children, other brothers went through. They were all massacred. So I'm carrying this gun. I'm not a terrorist. We are not terrorists. We don't shoot people. We don't carry guns. We don't fight. But in these circumstances, we are forced to do that. So, in April, I was back. Who comes to me? Tall man comes running first to me. Brother, you are back. Look at me. Do I look like a terrorist? I looked at him up and down again. I said, no. He cut his beard. He made it half the size. I said, nah, that beard is international standards. You're not a terrorist. It's fine. That was not the issue. The issue was they took offense to be called terrorists. Because by doing that, we were cutting the support out of them. And the world said, Al-Qaeda coming in. The resistance fighters coming in. And when they see Free Syrian Army, they lump Al-Qaeda, the extremists and others together as Free Syrian Army. The Free Syrian Army are Syrians. They are not an army. Yes, they got some generals, they got some soldiers who defected from the far side. But by far and large, they are students, 15 years old, 21 years old, farmers, teachers, agricultural students, laborers, who got no military training whatsoever. My biggest anxiety was not Assad's bombs. My biggest anxiety was the Free Syrian Army. Why? Because they got no idea about gun control. They just turned the gun in the street like this, AK-47, play with the guns this way. I said, you'll shoot somebody. I didn't have to say it. The amount of patients we saw shot by themselves and shot by each other because they are not an army. I said, you guys are dangerous. You are more a threat to yourself than an outside force. So I called the commander and I said, my friend, when you fight a war, the Quran tells you make preparation. This Islamic teaching, not my teaching. I can't tell you my own words. I said, you see the Bosnians? When they were ordinary people, in 2.5 years they trained. And in 2.5 years they had a 200,000 strong trained military from civilians and 100,000 reserve. What is this? Outside the hospital, you shoot guns. Every time something happens, you shoot guns. I said, what kind of discipline is this? I said, do me a favor. Take 2 hours every day and train your people. You'll save some lives. You know what he tells me? We'll train after the war. I said, another thing, Adam. Sorry. How can you train after the war? You train before the war and for the war. No, no, we'll train after the war. We can't wait. No, we're too busy. Is this an army? Is this the world called terrorists? We've got no idea what's going on. And then to add to all this comes the greatest heroes of all time, Iran. You see, they promoted the revolution, the Islamic revolution, for so many years. And we all were excited and we helped Iran. Oh, the Americans want to stop the nuclear weapons. And Americans are doing this and Americans are doing that. The biggest devil in this war, and I'm saying devil like it is Iran. You measure according to Quranic standards. And the bigger devil than that is those that call themselves liberation movement, freedom fighters, fighters for the cause of Palestine, Hezbollah. Their name is now Hizbul Shaitan. Measure it by Quranic standards. What does the Quran say? The Quran says you fight injustice. You fight oppression. You fight for the cause of the weak and the oppressed and the hurt. And you fight for a fair war. You don't cut the throats of women and children. You don't burn women and children. You don't kill animals. You don't bomb mosques and madrasas. You don't bomb schools and hospitals. You don't destroy and burn crops. You don't cut off water and you don't cut off electricity. And when you capture a prisoner, you don't torture him. You don't tie him. You share your food with your prisoner even if your food is less. That is Islamic standard. None of the above is followed by either Hezbollah or Syria or Iran. We're sending medical support, military support, and men, soldiers to support Assad. And who are they killing? I'm sorry, they are making this a sectarian war. We have never started a sectarian war in our history. Iran is doing it. What Hezbollah and Assad's killing innocent people. 95% of those wounded in this war are civilians, men, women, and children. These are not fighters. Iran made a big noise. Ah, Bahrain is a predominantly Shia state, and the Sunnis are a minority. Why are they in control? For Iran's information, Syria is a 15% Alawite state and 85% Sunni state. And the Sunnis did not get up and fight all the time. In 1982, Hafiz al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father, wiped out 35,000 Sunni Muslims. He just shot them down. In 2011, the people of Syria walked through the streets. These are Sunni Muslims. They walked through the streets calmly and saying, they didn't say, we 85% want to replace your 15%. All they said is, we want a better system of government, better freedoms, better democracy. Women and children walked in the streets in Al-Darah. And 3 hours later, Assad's security police came and took the children away, 10 to 12 of them, 8 years old, 10 years old, and 12 years old. Took them to the prison and pulled out their nails and burnt them and tortured them. And when the parents went back to ask for his children to be released, they said, leave these children. You have other children, or make other children with your wives. And if you can't make other children with your wives, we will make them for you with your wives. This is the Iran, the Hezbollah, and Assad that we want to protect and defend? No, there's an American plan. You see, they want to make Assad strong to make Israel weak, make Assad weak to make Israel strong. Where is your concept? This is a straightforward case of oppression and injustice. And people are standing up to fight against an oppressive government. It's a straightforward thing. Yes, you know, Americans will put their fingers in everywhere. They will interfere. They will try to control the outcome of any war. If they were getting free rein, this war would have been over 1.5 years ago. If weapons were going in, this war would have been over 1.5 years ago. Because they would have stopped him a long time ago. No, this war is to be controlled. They will not allow a Sunni state to exist in the middle of the Middle East. A pure Sunni state, because these are pure Muslims. And when I went back in October, I went back in December. And when I came back in December, something came back into my mind. I belong to a Sufi tariqa. My Sufi sheikh sat with me in January 1999. I was sitting in his house in Istanbul. And we were talking about a whole lot of things. He speaks Turkish. I understand when he speaks Turkish. I don't understand a single word of Turkish if somebody else speaks. I speak English, he doesn't understand a word of English. But when I speak English, he understands. This is the grace of Allah. So he told me that out of discussing a whole lot of things, he said, they will destroy Syria. I'm thinking to myself, what is he talking about? 1999, we're talking about a whole lot of different issues, and suddenly looks me into my eye and says, my son, they will destroy Syria. I couldn't understand. A lot of things that he told me, I understood 10 years later. And when I went back into Turkey outside Syria, I now understood what he was saying. They were so smart internationally, they gave us the impression that the rich Muslim countries are looking after the refugees. They tried to corrupt our minds to say, you know what, we're going to make Israel weak, strong, and make everybody else weak. There is no such thing. And look at the other thing they said, Al-Qaeda is coming in. Now explain to me, please, I need somebody to help me understand this. From where is Al-Qaeda coming in? Most of them are coming in from the Jordanian border. There are 7,000 to 10,000 American troops in Jordan. Are they coming with their permission or against them? You work it out. 10,000 Americans with all the satellite equipment can't make out that Al-Qaeda is coming to the Jordanian border. There is an international plan, yes, not to strengthen Israel, to destroy the formation of a Syrian state, Sunni state in Syria. That is the international plan, and we missed it all. Again in Darkush, the same young ones took us to the center of the city. They said, we just pushed back Assad's army a few weeks ago. Come to the mosque. And they took us to the mosque, and the bomb had fallen through the mosque. You Muslim? You call our Islamic revolution in Iran? Your revolution allows you, your Quran allows you to bomb mosques? Because I don't know which Quran you're using. My Quran doesn't allow me to bomb mosques. Nor does it allow me to bomb religious sites or hospitals and innocent people. My Quran doesn't teach me to fight, to support oppression. It teaches me to fight oppression and injustice. So I don't know what book you're following. So they said, watch the bombs. The mosque was bombed. And then as they were talking, the bombs started falling in the city. They grabbed me a number. They said, we have to get out from here. I said, why? They said, the bombs are falling. So I said, so what? They said, no, you can't die here. It's on our conscience. You see our tradition. We are Syrian Arabs. Our tradition says we guard our guest with our life. You cannot die here. You have to get out of here. So they take us and put us in the cars and drive off, and the two cars bang. But nothing major. Then they take us to the plantation. And as I get to the plantation, I'm speaking to other Syrians. All this is, they speak Arabic and it's translation. While I'm speaking to them, a lady comes walking from far. And from the corner of my eye, I get six sense telling me, this woman is coming to me. That started making me very uncomfortable, because Arabs, Syrian Arabs, is a very conservative society. The women don't mix freely. They're all properly covered, head to toe, every single one. Child, teenager, woman, all fully covered. They don't mix. They only mix as families, husband and wife, and men and women as families. I'm a foreigner. She walks right and comes and stands right next to me. And then she looks me in the eye. She says, can I talk to you? I said, you speak English? She said, yes. I said, what's your name? She said, my name is Nood. She said, I'm the English teacher. But in my mind, why would the woman come and stand right next to me? It's desperation. Because the world has cut them off. We've left them alone. She said, can you come with me? So I walk with her 200 meters. And her husband was in that group, so he comes with. She says, meet this lady, meet this one, meet this one. That one talks about the horror of how her husband was tortured by Assad. How this one was killed, how the child was killed, how this one is missing. And they gave me all the sad stories of depression, of sadness, of horror. And then the people started running down the mountains because the bombs had just fallen, remember? So the people are running down the mountains. She said, you see? Who's running? Terrorists. Can you see all these terrorists? It's women and children, bruised, cut, injured, coming through, running, going in the car, going in the truck, going on motorbike, anything to take them away. Then she said, why doesn't Assad fight the fair fight? Why doesn't he inform us that he doesn't like us when we must leave the city? So we will leave. No, his soldiers just walk in and they fire at random, killing women and children. Then the tank shells come and then the missiles come and we die in these huge numbers. All these women and children, can you see any terrorists here? And we move out in that numbers. And then she said, Israel has compassion. Assad has no compassion. Assad is worse than Israel. Can you imagine an Arab saying that? Can any Arab imagine any Muslim, for any Muslim saying that? She said it. And it was said with a passion, the way the lady said it. 2 days before that, I was in Azaz. We went to the rebel army headquarters. Rebel army headquarters. The customs point when you cross into Mozambique, that's the rebel army headquarters. The customs building. The guy sitting on the burqa, what they had, what a one gun, that's the head office. The terrorists and the rebels, they are fighting, the strong fighters. They want to displace Syria and make Israel stronger because there's an international plan. What nonsense is all this? The youngsters tell me, don't listen to what all these people have to say. You make up your own mind. Make your own impression. Don't say tomorrow we polluted your mind and made you partial. You see for yourself, you talk to who you want, you ask the questions, we will not interfere. Go anywhere you want, you choose the spot. So I said, take me to some destruction. They take me to the destruction, two youngsters, me and Ahmed are together. They get out of the car and they start sobbing. You are young here. How common it is for you, 21 years old, to sit and start crying? Is that common for men, for youngsters? How common is that? No, we are macho, we don't do that, we don't cry. 21 years old, they start crying. So I asked them, what happened? They said, do you know from this site, a few days ago, a man went in search of food for his family. As you know, there is no food in Syria. We have no economy, no functioning factory, no functioning industry, no production. You saw our plantations, they all dead. We have nothing. And there's no aid agencies. You can see there's no aid agencies here, and you can see no media. There's nobody here. We're cut off from the world. So he goes in search of food. He said he came back 4 hours later with dried bread that was 5 days old. But the problem was Assad had reception for him. While he left, Assad's airplanes came and dropped the bombs on those houses. 72 people died, women and children only. 13 members of his family died. All 13 members of his family died. So when this man came, he came, corpse. He came to feed the corpse, they were all dead. Now I could understand why they were sad and emotional. I said, take me to a camp. They took me to a camp. It's not a camp in the standard way. Most of them are living outside in the open air. Some living like a garage cover. Others living in tents in inverted commas. These are not tents. These are Hessian sacks. You put the water through and the water goes right through. Unfortunately, in Syria, like in Cape Town, it rains in winter. So it's wet and it's cold. And they get soaked inside in that manner. And as I walked in, a 7 or 8 year old child comes with a bowl of olives. I'm thinking to myself, if I eat this, what is the child going to eat? I said, I can't eat this. My host says, you have to eat. Otherwise, you'll insult our generosity. We'll insult our being a host to you, our hospitality. I said, but what is the child going to eat? They said, that's not your problem. So I eat, and others eat, and the bowl of olives gets finished. It can't go down my throat. Because I'm there 4 times, and I've seen the inside story. They hide their difficulty. They cover their hardship. They eat once in 7 days. They take turns, they rotate to eat, and they give you a big smile. So when I was in the hospital, and my media team and medical team was eating in the room, in the media room in the hospital, and when the door was open and we were eating the sandwich, and when the child was standing at the door and looking at the teams, with that longing in the eyes, I became hysterical. I said, shut the door. They said, what's the issue? I said, you're eating and the child is starving. But they give you a big smile. They don't ask for your food. They don't ask for your tea. They don't ask for your coffee. They don't ask for your money. This is their dignity and integrity. But they eat once in 7 days. We waste. We're extravagant. We don't appreciate what we have. And they're hungry and they smile. That we were in the hospital in Darkush. Time is short, I'm cutting the story. We went in Darkush. When I went there in October, I found the building. Or rather say, Allah showed me the building. Dr. Ahmed Gandur went with me. I said, yes, this is the one. We will convert this building into a hospital. In December, I went back. And they said, we had to start. In 75 days, bombing, raining, no fuel, high fuel price, fuel shortage, no production, no economy, nothing happening. Bringing everything from Turkey. In 75 days, that building got converted into a fully-fledged hospital with 2 theaters, fully equipped. ICU, labor ward, pharmacy, laboratory, wards, casualty, outpatient generator, kitchen, storeroom, special extra stores, and cooking area and washing area. All that in 75 days with all the supplies, fully equipped. Do it in any first world country. You cannot do that. This is a war zone. With all the difficulty and transport hardship. Yes, we gave the money. But Allah, by His grace, made them do that. Thursday night, 18th of April, I'm standing in the hospital. My son and I are the only two in the hospital. It's 11 o'clock at night. Patient comes to me. She says, "My son," this is now in Arabic, I'm just telling you in English. "My son, I said I'm going to give you a present just now. On Thursday night and Friday Jummah, He sends the best presents." Not even half an hour later, four missiles came, boom, into the mountain outside the hospital. And all the smell of those missiles you could get, strong smell of fumes. Now, I want to understand, if this is a conventional war, what do you fight in a war? You shoot a tank, you shoot a plane, you shoot heavy artillery, you shoot missile batteries, you shoot frontline soldiers. There is nothing in their bush. There are no frontline soldiers, no tanks, no planes, no missiles, no heavy artillery, because these guys have got no weapons. They have a couple of guns and things that they stole here and there. That is not weapons. It's insignificant. There's hospitals, there's mosques, there's madrasas, there's people. Why is it bombing, consistently bombing a city that's got no military value? It's a monster. So the bombs fell. She said, "Juma, it's worse." So in the next few days, my teams went to a mosque. The mosque that was. Because a few weeks previously, the bombs fell exactly at Juma time while they were reading Salah. And 120 Musallis got killed. This is the Iran, the Islam of Iran, of Hezbollah, and of Assad. What Hezbollah has had in a place called Homs, they have slaughtered 270 women and children, cut their throats and burned them alive. They did the same in Damascus, they did this 1,000 people in Tarsus, and in Crusade as they fell, there was no way you could take the injured people out. And they cut the water and they cut the electricity. The Islam of Hezbollah, of Iran, and Assad. I'm not saying that all Shias are bad. I'm not saying that all Alawites are bad. And I'm not saying that all Sunnis are good. I'm saying that Iran and Hezbollah and Assad are making this a sectarian war. They're hoodwinking the world to say everything is against us. It is not true. This is a pure fight against injustice and oppression, and they're hoodwinking the whole world. And we fell for the bait. They need all our support. They're hungry. They're starving. We need to do something. Because they will make Seri without food, and they will make iftar without food. We're expanding the hospital, we're sending supplies, food, medicine, things are going in all the time. Every week I'm transferring money in big dollars, every single week, to make sure they survive. And the saddest thing is, when we left the hospital that Thursday, when we left, you could see the pain in the eyes. You guys were our support. You guys were our backbone. You guys were our helpers. Who are we going to have now? They didn't say it, but the eyes told the whole story. The non-Muslims would be. Non-Muslims came with me. At every point when the bombs fell around the hospital, before I left home, I sent an SMS. When I got to Bramley, my logistics center, I sent an SMS. We got to RTM, I spoke to them personally. I said, "My friends, the bombs are falling around the hospital. Do you still want to come? I will not regard you as a coward if you pull out now. Some of you are single mothers and you have 9-year-old children at home. If something happens to you, what then?" Non-Muslim people answered me, "It is in God's hands." We got to Cairo, we got to Istanbul, we got to Antakya, and the final point before we crossed the border, I said, "You still have a chance, I'll put you in a plane and send you back home." We crossed the border. I asked them again. Because as they crossed the border, Assad's presence came, boom, the missiles started coming to the mountain. They asked me, "Why do you keep asking us this? We adults, we know where we're going. We're not going for a party, we're going to a war zone." They said, "Do you think God Almighty will harm us? We came to serve His people. People who need it most. Nothing will happen to us." On that Saturday, when these crazy Syrian soldiers of the Free Syrian Army ran into the hospital, they get excited. When one guy gets shot in the hand, 15 people come into the hospital. And they make big chaos and they scream and they shout. The doctors got a hell of a shock that day. At the end of after the Juma time, I said, "Would you like to go home?" The team was leaving the next day, half the team, and another team was coming. One of the team members, a Christian guy from Durban, an orthopedic surgeon, said to me, "Phone my boss. I can't go back. They need me here more than they need me at home." So I phoned his boss. I said, "Madam, he's staying with me." She said, "No problem, keep him." I said, "Your boss wants you to die." So they served and they helped. And that's the dedication and the commitment from non-Muslim people came and served with heart. And then the last story of all, I told you, they got no gun control. It was the best day of our stay in Sanya that morning. Monday we came in, the bombs fell as we tried to cross the border and we got in. Tuesday we were organizing two facilities because we set up another clinic also. We saw 7,000 patients in 10 days. But many operations, the dirty twins and a whole lot of things. The third day the medical guys came, are they ready for war now? Orthopedic surgeons, general surgeons, urologists all ready. Walked into the hospital. When I went in October, Darkush was dead. No shops functioning, no people in the street. December was slightly better, March slightly more. The day we arrived in April, the streets were full, the shops were open, the cars were outside the hospital, the motorbikes, the people in the streets were packed. You'll never say a war is taking place here. We walked in, the doctors were working, 12:30. They rushed in with an emergency. 8 of the trauma doctors got onto the patient, put the patient on the bed, trying to cut around the heart, ventilation, all kinds of CPR. What happened? 9-year-old child shot through the heart. His father came in all distraught, running to try to push him out. Then the people felt some compassion. They said, no, don't do that. Let him come inside. The father came inside, started stroking the legs of his child, holding the ankles and turning it, and turning the other way and doing that. Why? Because the father was cleaning his gun, pointing at his child, and shot him himself. Can you imagine that? And 5 minutes later, we told him, your child is dead. We walked outside. The mother broke down. It's the most horrendous sight I've ever seen. The way the lady broke down, it was heartbreaking. 69 of us, used to trauma, used to war, used to emergency. 69 of us just collapsed. We sat down. We couldn't function. The soul was gone, the spirit was gone, the energy was gone. We couldn't walk for 35 minutes. We were paralyzed. We couldn't do anything. Not because one child died. Because this one child was symbolic of what happens every minute of every hour of every day in every part of Sharia for the last 2 years while we all been sleeping. And for your information, we were in the best part of Sharia. We can't leave them alone. I never go on a lecture to asking for money. This time I'm asking for the sake of those people that the whole Muslim world is cut off. Open your hearts, open your souls and give whatever you got as extra. Because the dua that they've already given you before you even send something, you'll never be able to pay back for another 100 years if you live so long. And as we left the hospital, the guy who speaks English, he says, we don't know why this is happening to us. But we accept what is happening to us because it is from Allah. We cannot fight Allah. We will not complain. We will accept it. We can pray for Allah's mercy. He said, maybe you will come back. Maybe you will not come back. And maybe if you come back, I may not be here. I'm only giving you one dua, that whatever happened to me, my children, my wife, my progeny, the Syrian people, whatever happened to them, we pray that this does never happen to you, your people, your team, your family, your children, and your country. That's the only dua we give you. Brothers and sisters, open your hearts for them. Pray for them with sincerity, with concentration and dedication. Pass the word around and don't let the world hoodwink you. The Sunnis are getting massacred inside Syria by outside forces who claim to be Muslim. Don't sleep. We're not making a sectarian issue, but the reality is what's happening on the ground is becoming a sectarian issue. JazakAllah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Brothers, please come forward and record yourselves for the Jummah Salat, inshallah. After the Jummah Salat, there will be a collection outside for the blanket drive for collection of money from blankets for the needy in the northern areas, inshallah. JazakAllah.